Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Fireside Chat with Lucas Lundin, hosted by Stifel GMP. I'd like now to turn the meeting over to Ian Parkinson. Please go ahead.
Good day, everyone. My name is Ian Parkinson, and with my partner, Tyron Breitenbaugh, we will be sharing hosting duties for today's call. Tyron and I are both part of the Stifel GMP Mining Equity Research Team based in Toronto. On behalf of myself and my partners across Stifel, I'd like to welcome you to our Fireside Chat with Mr. Lucas Lundin, and thank you all for joining us today. We're very happy to have Mr. Lundin with us for our Fireside Chat. Mr. Lundin has a very distinguished career in the resources sector. Lucas is a graduate of the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. Post-graduation, Mr. Lundin headed International Petroleum Corp's oil and gas operations. From 1990 to 1995, he was president of International Musto Exploration Limited, and was responsible for Musto's acquisition of the El Hombrero deposit. His pursuit of highly prospective properties around the world has resulted in numerous resource discoveries, including the multi-million ounce Veladero gold discovery. Mr. Lundin has also led several companies through highly profitable business acquisitions and mergers, such as Lundin Mining Corp's $3.3 billion merger with Euros Inc. Mining and the $9.2 billion sale of Redback Mining Inc. Joining Lucas on the call are also Adam and Jack Lundin. Adam Lundin is the CEO of Jose Maria. Adam has a background in oil and gas and mining technology, investment advisory, international finance, and executive management. After beginning his career with several Lundin Group mining companies in various countries around the world, he moved into finance, where he specialized in international institutional equity sales. Jack Lundin is the CEO of Bluestone Resources. Jack was recently involved in the very successful execution of Lundin Gold's Fruto del Norte gold mine in southern Ecuador, where he served as project superintendent. Prior to his time with Lundin Gold, Jack gained experience in mine project development through time spent in the field with various Lundin Group companies. Gentlemen, thanks again for being with us today. A few housekeeping issues before we get started, and I'll be brief. All the callers, you received instructions for the Q&A portion of the call, which will be later on. Tyron and I also publish research reports on issuers that will be discussed today. In those reports, you will find appropriate disclosures, and also this session will be recorded for distribution to a broader client audience at a later date. So with that, we'll get started. Again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Lucas, thanks for joining us. We've witnessed a very volatile last 10 to 12 weeks in the commodity space. What's your view of commodities that will do well coming out of the COVID-19 crisis in the early days of recovery?
I think in early days of recovery, I think especially copper has been heavily underinvested, and that was not what's going on in their business development and investment in new assets. So, and with the recovery of COVID-19, I think the copper supply is going to be tight, and I see a pretty bright future in copper in the next 2-3 years. You know, not enough supply and more demand. So I'm quite optimistic today. Another one, everybody's going to be surprised. Oil and gas looks quite interesting to me. Never seen it in business. You know, we produce 100 million barrels a day, we consume 100 million barrels a day, and suddenly we drop by 30%, so we've down to 70. And the supply destruction has been enormous since, you know, most of the oil and gas supply demand over the last 10 years comes from shale oil in the U.S., which, you know, is a treadmill. You have to keep investment in a certain oil price to make it work. And it has to be about $30 or $30 or more. So I see that the shale oil in the U.S. is going to disappear quite quickly. I think we're already down 3 million barrels. And that's most of the oil supply, like I said previously, came out of a shale oil business, not from anywhere else. So I think there's the structure supply, and then when demand comes back, it could still be quite strong. I could see it throughout the $30 Brent, and I could see that 60 by year end. So, I mean, that's a 50 to 100% move in the oil. So I'm quite bullish on that. And if all these infrastructure programs they're talking about in the U.S. and in China and the rest of the world, you know, iron ore could be strong because we have also a bit of supply deficit there. You know, we have Brazil that has supplying about 30 million tons less of iron ore, which looks very encouraging. And then nickel and zinc are nickel tougher to predict. Zinc, if we see an expansion economy, could come back. You know, it's a tough metal to predict. But I think copper, iron ore, and in oil is looking very favorable. And then I don't know if you call it gold, of course, is another commodity which we are very bullish on. And, you know, with all this printing of money and, you know, inflation is going to be around the corner one day, so hard assets can be very good. And we're quite bullish over the gold price over the next 2-3 years. You know, it's very much it's a hard asset. It's the only real currency around, if you ask me.
Okay, and if you look farther out, you know, say 5 to 10 years, post-COVID-19, with the continuing electrification of global transportation networks, what commodity do you think will stand out 5 to 10 years from now versus today?
I'm very bullish on copper. I think copper is the one that really can stand out.
Okay. Is there a commodity that you're bullish on that's off the radar for most investors, something that's just simply not getting any airtime whatsoever?
The toughest commodity in the world, uranium.
Yeah.
You know, if you know, it's the best energy in the world, it's always been overlooked, and it's been very underperforming over the last 5-6 years. And we see, you know, the shutdown some of the big mines, Cameco has, and Kazakhstan is shutting down some of the institute leaching. So, you know, uranium could have a new light, you know, in the future. But it's been a very tough commodity to predict.
Okay. You and I have both been through several cycles in our careers. What similarities do you see with the current situation that we're all living through compared to other low points in previous cycles through your career?
I think this is a tough cycle because, you know, we have this lockdown and shutting down all economies, and it's going to take a while for that to recover. You know, airlines not flying, you know, people are consuming less, and, you know, I could see, you know, it's going to take a while for the economy to recover. I think this is much tougher than 08 or 09 to come back from. You know, I know they printed a lot of money, so, you know, it's got a lot of money into the system, but, you know, it's going to squeeze the middle class, and I see 2-3 months could be quite tough ahead of us.
Okay. Changing gears slightly here. If Tyron and I and the rest of my mining colleagues, we can't go into a meeting with clients without the topic of ESG being discussed. I mean, the idea that ESG is everywhere. What's changed within the Lundin Group of companies' approach to ESG over the recent past?
I think ESG is super important. You know, in the old days, you know, we talk, we build a mine or, you know, the gas field, you know, pay our taxes, you know, and everything be okay. But today, you know, we have to be super involved. I think, you know, we just finished building a mine in Ecuador, Fruta del Norte, which is actually the first Western investment in mining business in the country that we had. And ESG was super important. We didn't have done the right studies, didn't have the right engagement, local community and the local region. You know, we never got it off the ground. So ESG, I think, is as important as the asset now. You know, you can't go in and build this asset and invest all this money without making sure, you know, you have tried to create local employment, try to buy a lot of goods locally, you know, and trying to get them involved so they have that they feel like that their ownership and asset as you have, because if you don't have that, you know, we get civil unrest and people are worried and think you're just, you know, they're taking the gold out of their country and, you know, the foreigners are making all the money and the locals are making no money, you know, despite that we pay very high taxes to the federal government. So I think ESG is super critical nowadays.
Okay. I think one of the first Lundin Group of Company projects I ever visited was Tanki Fungurumi in the Congo.
Yeah.
Living through or witnessing what goes on the ground, definitely very important. What do you do within the Lundin Group of Companies with your approach to ESG that sets you apart from other groups? Now, I'm thinking more across the entire leadership platform that you have.
Yeah, I don't think it sets apart. I think I think the whole industry is trying to do the same. I mean, the important thing is to engage with the government and, you know, in the private community, you know, we don't want to go in there and act, you know, we look better and that we, you know, we negotiated this deal. We got the deposit. We found this deposit, and now we're going to run it the way we want. I think it's very important to engage everybody. So again, so everybody thinks they're part of the story. You know, I think it's time to, you know, you don't want them and us. You want everybody together. So I think that approach that our people has is, you know, that super important to get everybody involved, and so they feel part of the whole process. If you not feel part of the process, you get social unrest and social issues. And it's easy for companies, you know, always blame the host government, but half the time, you know, it's half our mistake, half the host government. You know, it's not, you know, we nationalized or somebody did nationalization, but usually that's a cause because, you know, we haven't acted well and we couldn't get along with the government itself. So it's very important to bring everybody together when we get involved in projects. And I think you see that a bit in Tenke. I should not throw eggs around, but, you know, Tenke, I think the social issues in Tenke now, since we have our Chinese partners, have been much tougher, you know, because they have kind of ignored that side of the equation. So, you know, I think Tenke has more problems than we used to have.
Okay. Tyron, I'll kick it over to you to ask a few more questions from your side.
Thanks, Ian. Guys, so just sort of expanding on Ian's ESG question here, I've always been curious how much preparation or investigation work you guys do before you enter a new region, because your timing has just been uncanny. So I'm just curious if you can elaborate on what sort of prep work you guys are doing before you make that big decision to move into a new frontier.
I think what we do, you know, we have to go down there. You know, I like to go personally down and talk. And first, you have to talk on the federal level to make sure they want to happen. And then, you know, and then you have to go down to local level, make sure they're also happy. So basically, you know, you go in there and you embrace the government and say, you know, we want to invest this amount of money, but, you know, we have to do this, again, as a partnership. You know, we have to work together because, you know, in Ecuador, we invest $1 billion. And when we're down and met them early on, he said, you know, I can't invest this money if you don't want us to do it. You know, we have to work together to do this. So, you know, so I think it's engagement early on, you know, to make sure that everybody is on the same page. And if you're not on the same page, I mean, it's, you know, then it's how you do it. Of course, the first thing, the most important thing is to find the correct asset. You know, it has to be a great asset. And then if the asset looks great, or if you found a great asset, then the next step is to engage to get a second step with the federal and local governments and communities. It's no magic. And never forget that we're hosts, you know, in all these countries. It's their metal, their country. You know, we're here as contractors. You know, we don't. I mean, we're just there to help out, and we'd like to make some money, and we'd like them to make some money. You know, you never go in with the attitude, this is our deposit. It's their deposit we're working for.
Got it. And then, obviously, your execution in Ecuador at FDN has been almost flawless. It's kind of rare that you see a mine plan on paper, you know, be brought to life that well. And I think it's a good example of showing how mining companies can be good social citizens. So I guess I have a question here, and maybe it's directed towards Jack and Bluestone Resources. Obviously, Bluestone and Guatemala possibly on a similar trajectory here as Lundin Gold. So I'm just curious how you would rank Guatemala, Cerro Blanco, and its challenges versus when you first started to seriously develop FDN in Ecuador, and whether there are any big similarities or differences between those two situations.
Yeah, Jack here. So thanks for the question. I think that there are a lot of similarities. There are a lot of parallels that can be drawn, and we're definitely trying to replicate the things that worked at Fruta del Norte over at Cerro Blanco. But it is a different country. The deposit is different. The jurisdiction we're working in is different. And so I think we're actually at more of an advantage where Cerro Blanco is. The work that's been done on the project to date is significantly more than what was done at Fruta del Norte prior to us getting there. And the fact that Guatemala already has, you know, they've had operating mines, large-scale mining in the country. And so they kind of have a stronger understanding of mining and what it means to go from one phase to the next. And so, you know, there's lots of things and lessons learned that we're taking from Fruta del Norte, and then you have to apply or modify the model to work at, you know, the new jurisdiction. And so, you know, not trying to reinvent the wheel, trying to replicate the success, but obviously modifying it so that it's applicable to southern Guatemala.
Right, and it looks like you've been able to just use the exact same guys and in some instances the same contractors as you were making use of at FDN.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, fortunately, I lived through the experience of building Fruta del Norte, and so I saw what worked and what didn't. And, you know, we did develop a very strong team, and we built some very good relationships. And the relationship building is, you know, it's key to success. And so, you know, when the time is right, I'd like to bring more people over to the Cerro Blanco to help with that development. And I think we've talked about this before, but you know, when you're in mining, there's obviously many different phases, and so project people tend to go to different projects. They don't like to stay into operations, and so the fact that Fruta del Norte is now, I mean, unfortunately it's on care and maintenance, but it's essentially in operation phase. The project people are looking for something new, and so being able to, you know, in terms of timing, it's almost perfect to be able to bring the key people, the strong people that worked at Fruta del Norte over to Cerro Blanco and you know, look at trying to build this one now.
Got it. And then just while we're on the topic of management and talent, I have a few more questions here before I hand it back to Ian to talk about M&A. And, I mean, obviously you guys have been successful at different styles of assets across different jurisdictions. So how do you recognize this kind of talent at the early stages? How do you hold on to these managers as you continue to build out?
I think, you know, we have a team that's been around, and most of the guys that work with me has been around for 10 to 20 years. You know, so they're a very loyal team, and they understand how we work, and it builds up over time. You know, we started smaller, and we kept the good guys, and some of the good guys became CEOs of some of the vehicles. And, now it's for a younger generation. So Jack and Adam have to find the next generation of people to do this. But, you know, I think we have a very solid background of people that we've worked together for a long time, you know, so we understand what we want together. And then we're lucky enough been able to bring in on the construction side, very capable people, but the top always has been the same mentality. So, you know, I think that's been very fortunate to have the right guys that want to build a story with us. And it takes a long time to build this up. You know, it's not instant success, and it's very hard to find the right people to understand, because sometimes we hire somebody from a big corporate organization, it's hard for them to understand entrepreneurial spirit. They're more busy managing up and downwards and sideways than building the company, you know, so it takes time.
Got it. And I mean, obviously, one of the biggest challenges facing the sector here is just continuing to attract smart young people. I remember when I graduated my geology class, there were 8 of us. It wasn't a very flashy profession. So what are some of the things, you know, do you think we can do as an industry to keep smart, intelligent, young people engaged with the mining space?
I think, you know, we need to mechanize or get more on the technology side. I think we have to push that more than we did before. You know, we're a bit dinosaurs at moving forward, you know, automated trucks, better mills and all that. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there. But what I've done is, of course, you know, business is not very sexy anymore, so, you know, so it's hard to compete. Young talents want to go to the high-tech firms, which are flying and high, you know, so it's tougher for us to attract young people to our organization, to our side of business, because, you know, it's not as attractive as going to Facebook or Amazon or some of these tech companies. I don't know if Jack and Adam have anything to add here on this.
Yeah, Jack here. I mean, I think, as well, it's a sensitive topic, mining and natural resource extraction. And so in the industry, I mean, when you're talking with your peers, everybody kind of understands the importance. But when you're talking kind of in the broader broader scope, people look at mining and oil and gas as something that is negative for the environment, and they don't really take into consideration how absolutely necessary it is to advance and, you know, to make things more efficient in the world. And so when things work and there's success in mining or oil and gas, our peers are commending us, but then if something goes wrong, then the world is really frowning upon it. So it is it takes some courage to enter this type of industry. And so we're working hard to try and, you know, change that. And we want to, you know, work with universities to try and help bolster their mining programs, because if you can't get them involved at a younger age, then that's where there's that supply gap of good, hardworking people in the industry. So we are trying to see how we can support at the university level.
Yeah, that's a good point to try and catch them early and maybe impart some of the fun that you can have in this sector as well. Obviously, there's a lot of travel involved, and you know, these are big, exciting projects for a young engineer. So I think I'm going to hand it back to Ian here to maybe talk about some of the forces at play in the M&A space.
Thanks, Tarun. So what in recent years we've seen a lot of asset divestment that the Lundin Group at large has benefited from. Do you see the tide turning at all? And how do you think the seniors, whether it be at the base metal, industrial metal side, or the precious metal side, are approaching their growth profiles going forward?
I think they're a bit gun shy, the seniors. You know, I don't think, you know, they, in 2008, they already have they sold off of assets. You know, Freeport had all his troubles after that. So they have to sell asset opportunity wise. It was very good. This time around, you know, they're better. All the senior miners are better financed and better balance sheets. So it's tougher to find assets, you know, from them. I was questioning if, you know, some of their head size or, so, you know, I think mergers is going to be more than asset acquisition. And then, of course, greenfield, you know, build. I think, you know, it's probably time to build new assets too. You know, but I don't see right now a lot of divestment from the seniors. But you might think they've done that already.
Right. And when you're looking through the portfolio and other portfolios, what are the key deliverables, the key ideas that you look for with when you're looking at assets? Is it on the cost base, or is it opportunities for you to unlock ESG?
It's mostly, it comes down to economics to start with. And then, you know, if the economics makes sense, then we look at ESG. And also, it's tons and grades. And you know, obviously, you get to a certain size, you need some volume. You know, the assets, you know, small assets, not that interesting. You know, if they're small, that'd be very high value rack, high grades, you know, to make sense, you know.
Okay.
At the end of the day, you know, we're very bullish. You know, the big porphyry copper gold assets are very interesting.
And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, gold price was much lower than today, and we've seen spits and starts on the copper side. But the Lundin Group of companies has been able to keep the drill bits turning over recent years. Do you see exploration becoming more and more of a focus for the group going forward? I'm thinking Jose Maria, Filo, projects like that.
Yeah, but then, you know, those projects have been working on for 20 years, so they're coming to, Jose Maria is coming into, so Feast coming out, you know, and then Filo is another big, extremely large, could be 5 to at least 5 million tons of rock there, so, and we've got some very good intersections. So that, for sure, we can spend some more money drilling. But complete greenfield, probably less. You know, we have those advanced projects we work on a long time, 20 years. So, you know, so we can for sure advance them. But for complete greenfield, probably not.
Okay. And looking at asset valuations and transactions that we have seen, and I know they've only been limited, are you inclined to be more of a buyer or a seller in this market of assets?
I think we're more acquirer. You know, it depends. You know, some assets we have in a portfolio itself the right price, you know, and keep the higher margin assets. You know, it's always a question of in the portfolio to keep that's, you know, higher margin assets and less margin assets. Maybe somebody wants to buy them and sell them to try to high grade your portfolio over time.
Okay. So we heard Jack talk about the successful ramp up at Fruta del Norte. If another Fruta del Norte were to fall into your lap, as you're treasure hunting in this market, what, how would you handle that within the Lundin Group?
Today, it's a base metal producer, probably going to Lundin Mining. It's a gold asset, probably going to Lundin Gold. You know, Fruta is a bit of a unique occasion because that's what 5 years ago, gold price is very low, and Kinross had some problems with the governments, and we were able to buy an asset that somebody's spent $1.4 billion over $200 million, and then, you know, it's one of these real old assets, you know, there's not many fruits that's around, and it's just, it was the right time and opportunities. I think today we're very hard to find that again.
Okay. Operator Sean, at this point, we'd like to open the line to questions for any participants.
Absolutely. Thank you. So we will take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. So anytime you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause for participants to register for questions. Thank you for your patience. Our first question is from a participant. Participant, please state your name and company and proceed with your question. Your line is opened.
I mean, is it me? Hello?
Yes. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. I just wanted to get your thoughts. It's Grant from Wartaw. I just wanted to get your thoughts on Newcrest's purchase of the offtake on Fruta del Norte. Thanks.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's nothing changes. They basically, you know, Ryan and Blackstone have to want to sell and to monetize their royalty. And, you know, we're the same agreement, so we have an option to buy it back over the next 2 years. Obviously, Newcrest is very interested in the deposit in the company, so I think, you know, gives them they hope to get a stronger leg up, and it was a good deal for them, actually. You know, but we haven't.
Thank you. The next question is from Chris O'Connell from Stifel. Please go ahead. Your line is opened.
Thank you. And thank you to the Lundin family for hosting the call today. Just a question. You talked about oil and you thought that oil could see a meaningful rebound toward the back end of the year. I didn't hear the value of Brent / WTI. Do you think that spread is going to be a more widespread than historic because of the dynamics of the U.S. market versus not? And is it simply just a pickup of demand and a lessening of supply and that narrowing of that gap that informs your thinking, Mr. Lundin?
Yeah, I think, you know, the WTI and Brent had a very wide was $10 there for them, but that's because that's oversupply in the U.S. and no storage. I think that gap would narrow because I think the supply destruction in the U.S. is quite enormous. You know, so over time, I think that the gap's been closed over towards the end of the year again. And so I see that, and that interesting thing is, you know, that there's a lot of heavy oil in the U.S. been shut down, so the differential between WTI and our Canadian oil is only $4 today. It used to be 17 2 weeks ago.
And one final question, which was recently, 2 or 3 weeks ago, the WTI May contract actually traded at a negative value, which was historic and had never happened before. Do you or your sons have any opinion about what actually was really the major cause of that, and did you take anything away from that negative?
Basically, because, you know, the future oil contracts, you know, and the futures were sold forward, and there's a lot of the retail investors involved. And if don't forget the WTI, you have to take physical delivery when the contract expires. With Brent, you don't have to. So that what happened is just a lot of speculation in oil price and a lot of these future fund buying the oil. And then suddenly they take delivery, they don't have to have nowhere to do it. And they didn't know what to do with it, so they just had to dump it. So the people at stores took advantage of that. The WTI is very different. The physical is physically delivered every month once the contract expires. You know, so there's a lot of speculation in it, and I think people lost a lot of money. So I think, you know, we probably won't see it again, but we could see weakness to the end of May again, you know, when the delivery time comes on.
Thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
Thank you. Once again, please press star one if you have a question. Our next question is from Otto Chudy from Stifel. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you very much for doing this. We talked a little bit about ESG and, you know, the one of the areas of ESG is this whole transportation piece driven by use of lithium in the batteries in cars, for example. Is this an area, it's a special area, is this an area that you have looked at, and what do you think the importance is of lithium extraction?
I think lithium is very important. It's a, you know, small commodity markets. I've been involved in smaller markets before. They're very specialized, and usually very few people controlling it. It's very hard to get into. So it's a lot of work for, at the end of the day, not super big a turn, but of course, you know, people involved in it, you know, it's mostly lithium comes from Soca Mission in Chile. You know, and, you know, it's very hard to compete with them, but it comes from brine, and you can crank it up and down like they want. And I think this hard rock lithium mines is a much tougher job. You know, but I think lithium is today is quite important for battery component. I'm not sure what the energy is going to be the ultimate product going to put into these new batteries, but super interesting, but it's a very small market and it scares me a bit, so I'm stay away from it. It's very hard to make big money in it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from a participant. Please state your name and proceed with your question. Your line is opened.
Hi, Lucas. This is Ranjan. Good
day. Hi, Ranjan. How are you doing?
I'm really good. Lucas, you mentioned that you probably would be a buyer of assets as opposed to a seller of assets at this time. And you also spoke about four or five commodities. You know, gold, oil, copper, uranium. So I have two questions. One is, what price assumption would you make if you were taking an asset, buying an asset at this point of time, both in a one-year and a three-year time frame? How would you rank these four or five commodities? And then how do you flow through for the risk in everything else? For example, the COVID risk and the political risk and a lot of places which you're working in.
I think, well, let's say copper, I mean, this year, I mean, you probably get 250, but long term, over the next 2-3 years, I mean, 3 to 350, I would say, you know, and then risk while oil and gas is, you know, is very volatile, but I could see, I think it's going to be a V-shaped recovery because of the mostly supply destruction. And so having, I mean, then it depends where you are. You also, you know, the, I guess the places, the easier places to business now is like this more complicated places like Argentina because, you know, they're looking for investment, but at the same time, you know, you know, the world's a bit scarce. There's less competition there. And in Chile, of course, it's always interesting. But in the problem with Chile, the taxes are not that good, and the labor rules are tough. You know, so, you know, I think you have to, you know, today you have to be a bit braver, you know, look at, you know, I kind of like Argentina today.
Correct. And you did mention, you'd spoken about uranium, and you mentioned some of the shutdowns.
Like a Cigar Lake shut down, and, you know, they have some of the big assets in Kazakhstan shutting down because of COVID. So there might be some daylight in uranium for next year or two. But, you know, I've been involved for 20 years. I have to take it in 80 cents. It's been a long mystery. But I see some really happening in the business industry, yes, for sure.
And in gold, you can, a lot of the gold companies, like Lundin Gold and, hopefully Bluestone at the future point of time, the returns are even superior to what you would find in some of the copper companies or even some of the oil.
Yeah, today for sure, because, I think gold, the seniors have done a good job cutting their costs, and I think the average cost is $800, $900 an ounce. So the gold producers are in pretty good shape, and Fruta is about at the high 550, 580, So today the gold at 1700 has really, really good returns. And I think the market hasn't reflected that in the big gold stocks yet. And I think if we get another quarter, I think gold looks very, very good, very optimistic.
Gold equities. And how do you think of the commodity, based in different things?
I think the commodities will be quite good. As you know, I think, with this printing, there's no, I don't know about the hard assets. I think hard assets can be very good nowadays. I think gold looks super interesting over the next 2-3 years.
Thank you.
Because people are nervous.
Thank you. The next question we have is from Jean Blanchet from Forces New York. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah. Hey, Lucas. How are you? Thanks for...
Hey, Jean. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for hosting the call. I was just wondering, with regards to your three, smaller companies, Jose Maria, Filo, and NGX, do you have any plan to... what's your thinking going forward with those three companies, and are there any plans to, maybe put them back together to have a more sizable vehicle, or is the intention still to keep them separate?
I think we can keep them separate. We can separate them. I think, I almost look like five vehicles. On Jose, we're about to finish the study, and, we're talking about $3 billion projects. We're talking about early years, over 150,000 tons of copper, over 350,000 ounces of gold. It's very interesting. I think we just get the feasibility study done and then get some permitting and then see if we can do something with the government, see if they want us to invest. So I think that's keep it alone. We've gone very far, and we're almost at the finish line. The question is if you can get the government itself, Argentina, to, act correctly. On Filo, we have a big resource, oxide resource already. And then we just drilled some of the best drill holes in the world over the last year. We've had two holes of close to 1% copper over 1,000 meters. So that's an enormous system. I think we should keep working on that, shore it up. And then on Jose Maria, we have Vortex that's looking at an IPS. I think we should keep them separate because the assets are so big, so you can't. They all require billions of dollars in their own entities. So I think to put them together again makes no sense.
Okay, thank you.
Adam, you have anything to add on, Phil?
Yeah, I think it's just remarkable that, there are three different companies and three big projects, and it's a corridor where we own 100% of each project. They're all approximately 12 to 15 kilometers away from each other. But you're talking, combined over 15 billion pounds of copper, over 15 million ounces of gold, and over 225 million ounces of silver. We just got to get one in production, and then the rest they can feed into each other. And we're pushing Jose Maria first. So it's super exciting to be at this time involved with the companies and moving the projects forward.
Yeah, I think it's hauling a tiger by the tail, because once you get this region going, you have 50 years of a mine life here. So, it's just it's a question of how to get the fees done, and then the question of how to get it financed and built. And then once you get up and running, the whole district is gigantic, very, very big.
Parkinson, we no longer have any questions queued up at
this
time. One more, if you would like. Rob Weir from Stifel GMP. Mm-hmm. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, Lucas. Good good morning. I was just curious, operationally, you guys seem to have worked very well with G Mining in Ecuador, and now you're taking them down to Cerro Blanco. You know, they seem to just generate great results for the likes of IAM Gold and even Newmont. So I'm curious sort of what differentiates them and what makes them so successful going into these tougher jurisdictions.
I think they have a very dedicated team. They're very well run. You know? So G Mining's basically it's a Louis Gignac or Gignac show, you know, so all the other entities working there. And they've really done a lot of different projects and a lot of different experiences, you know, so I think they've applied the formula over and over and has been very, very successful. And they've done a very, very good job. It's always the same people they're with, you know, it doesn't change. So I think their success is due to continuity and management, which is basically a family run.
Hey,
yeah,
thanks a lot for doing this call.
I agree. I think that, you know, they take a similar approach that we do, that they, you know, they get fully integrated into projects. They move down to the site. They, you know, spend as much time as they need to really understand projects, and then they kind of build their blueprint and then go about executing it. And, again, you know, they have a strong team that follows them from project to project. And so, you know, when you work together, as I was mentioning, kind of that relationship that they have with their team is very strong. And so we're looking at, you know, building on our relationship with them. So it works out very well.
Okay. Appreciate it, guys. Thanks.
So we have no more questions at this time.
Okay. Tyron, do you have anything to close off with from your side?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, maybe I'm going to put you on the spot here, Lucas. If I was starting a gold fund today and had $5 million total to deploy to the Lundin universe, how would you spread that around?
Gold fund, I guess, five. Okay. I'll put, that'd be safe to put some into Lundin Mining. Lundin Gold, I put $3 million into Lundin Gold. I put, 1.2 into, Bluestone. It's a close call. And then, I put 800,000 into Philo.
I love that. I love the basket approach. So thank you, gentlemen, for your time. Okay. And giving us some insight into how you think, and we'll see if we're going to apply that to our PA here. So thank you very much, and please enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks.
Thank you, John.
For hosting call. Bye-bye.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Conference is now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.